At one time, there were an estimated 15,000 of the tall, majestic white birds. By the 1940s, there were fewer than two dozen, all in one flock that summered in northern Canada's Wood Buffalo National Park and wintered on the shores of Texas, just one hurricane or one oil spill away from disaster. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Joy Cardine. Wisconsin's work in bringing the whooping crane back from the abyss has been the stuff of legend, involving a new flock started in the Nisida Wildlife Area, incubating eggs with costumed conservationists raising the young birds and leading them to a winter homeland in Florida. This year, there was a record number of chicks born in the wild, but by mid-July, only a few had survived, leaving researchers both hopeful and worried about the whooping crane's future. Our guest this hour is Ann Lacey, Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. And Ann, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, good morning. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just figure out where we were and where we are right now. How many whooping cranes are now alive in the wild?
Alive in the wild. Well, here in Wisconsin, we have just less than about 100. In the wild population that you spoke about that migrates between Texas and Canada, there's a little over 300. So we're doing much, much better than we have historically. And we still have quite a few birds that are alive in captive breeding centers and various zoos in North America. And so they also form the basis of these reintroductions like we're doing in Wisconsin. So between wild populations that are slowly growing, so that's also a good thing, and the captive populations, we're doing pretty good.
Now, the low point for the whooping crane population was in the 1940s, and what I read is that there were somewhere around 21 birds that were alive at that time. Is that accurate?
That is, and the only spot that people would see them is in the Aransas, what is now the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge on the Texas coast. And sometimes you hear various numbers, 15 or 20, 21, and that's because there was also a non-migratory flock that was along the Gulf Coast, and at a certain point, their low point, there was only a few that were left in southern Louisiana, right in from the coast.
Well, they could have easily gone the way of the passenger pigeon or the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Absolutely.
How are we able to bring them back from the abyss?
Well, part of it is when we had that low point, people were like, well, we have to do something about these birds. And so protection of that habitat in the wintertime was big. So what they did is they made that Aransas National Wildlife Refuge. And that was a big part of it. Then they had to find out where they were breeding, which is really critical, obviously, point in their life when they're breeding. And it took almost a decade to discover where they were breeding up in the Northern Territories of Canada. Once they found that, they set about collecting eggs. And so what they would do is they would visit nests, and they would test the fertility of the eggs. And you can actually float them in water to determine if they are fertile.
Wow.
They would leave high science, you know, floating them in water. They would make sure that there was one fertile egg in the nest, and then they would take one, and that is what produced our captive populations. Once we had established captive populations, and we would encourage them to breed in captivity. And so then that pays forward. Fast forward to the 2000s, and we started reintroduction in Wisconsin, and that's a migratory population. There had been other experiments to reintroduce birds in other various parts of the United States, and they haven't worked out so well. And we're very hopeful that this one is, you know, because the population is climbing slowly, but it's climbing.
Well,
that'll take off.
That, you know, that's the subject of the show today. But I just want to clarify one thing that piqued my attention.
Yeah.
They didn't even know in the 40s and 50s where the whooping cranes were wintering. They had to discover their breeding grounds in northern Canada.
Correct. Yeah. They would show that these giant white birds would show up in Texas every year, and then they would leave in April, and they had no idea where they went. And so there was a lot of time spent in airplanes making transects. They knew that they would still fly north out of the Dakotas, and so they started in Saskatchewan, and they just kept going north until I believe it was a firefighter. They were doing smoke spotting for fire wildfires in Canada, and they saw white birds on the ground. And so word spread, and it got back to the biologists, and they concentrated on that area.
And Wood Buffalo,
where they were breeding.
Wood Buffalo National Park is kind of an isolated spot. It's not easy to get to.
It isn't.
That's probably a good thing for the cranes.
Correct. Yeah. At one time, we think historically, whooping cranes probably bred down through the Dakotas into Iowa in the prairie pothole regions. So they probably were never very numerous. And as western expansion happened, you know, through the 1900s, it hurt whooping cranes and a lot of other birds that depended on the prairies and those potholes for their existence too. So they were kind of scooched back up into that last stronghold.
So let's get back to these current numbers. We have about 300, you said, in that western flock?
Correct. That goes through the central flyway, about 300.
And in the flock that you've been establishing at Nisida and Wittering in Florida?
There's about 100 now that we have a pretty steady count of here in Wisconsin. There's some that managed to go over to Michigan, and there's a couple that wander through Illinois and Indiana. But it's been holding steady at about 100 birds now for several years, and so we're trying to make sure that we can still get that to nudge up between our reintroduction of young birds every year and the natural productivity that we're really trying to get going.
You started the reintroduction effort in Nisida in 2001, but it's been pretty challenging.
Very challenging, yes. Survival has been good. Once the birds get through their first migration as a youngster, when they make their first unassisted northward migration, that's really the most dangerous time for them. Migration for all birds is a very dangerous time, no matter the age, but especially for a young bird because they don't know the challenges along the way. For example, power lines, or they might not find safe water for roosting. But once they make it through that, and they don't have too many natural predators anymore that would threaten them, and so then the problem becomes, can they nest? And so these birds found partners, they established territories,
mm-hmm.
they would defend them, they built nests, they had eggs, fertile eggs. That was also something. It's not just laying an egg, they have to be fertile. And all of these goals, we could tick those off the list, but then we had our first nest in 2005, and then every year since then we've been kind of incrementally, as more birds enter the population, more birds age into that breeding phase, more and more nests, but we have a struggle with them with nest constancy. So they have a hard time staying on that nest.
Well, you've got a really low survival rate for new chicks. 24 of them were hatched from 37 nests this year. That's a record number. That's the good news. But by July, you only had 3 chicks left alive from that original 24. Why is the mortality rate so high for these birds?
Well, that might not be that far off from what would happen in nature. And unfortunately, that's the good news, the glass half full, is that we had a record number of chicks this year, and we actually have a record number of fledglings. So we hold on to that. You know, we have 3 right now that have fledged. And so once the chicks have fledged, that gets them out of another very, very large danger zone. So only 3 out of that 24? There's a lot that these birds have to overcome. So this is still a very, very young population, and so they're still learning how to be parents, learning how to defend their chick, learning what they have to defend it from. And unfortunately, we still have to go back and understand that this, in all whooping cranes in the world, are sharing the genetics from about 15 birds. And so we're not quite sure exactly what the genetics of these birds, how that might implicate in this problem with nesting too. And they are raised by humans. What are we teaching them that might be detrimental? What are we not being able to teach them because we're people and we're not cranes?
Well,
constant learning process.
But Ann, last year was even worse. Of the 13 wild hatch chicks, only one of them made that long trip south in the fall and successfully returned this spring, and that bird was killed in the spring, so none of the wild-hatched chicks last year made it.
Correct, yeah. We have only 2 surviving chicks right now that have fledged in the wild, and both of them are breeding birds. But You know, it's just one of those things that you can only control so much. And so all of the things that we're learning from this population are, you know, what are the threats that are anthropomorphic? What are those man-made things on the landscape that we can really control for?
Ann Lacy, hold that thought. We're talking to the research coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. We want to hear from you. Have you ever seen a whooping crane? What hopes do you have that we will be able to solve the problems that are facing this majestic bird and save it from extinction? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email message to talk@WPR.org or put a comment on the Joy Cardine Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be back after this break. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Joy Cardine. Our guest this hour is Ann Lacy, Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, as we look at the promise and the problems facing the new generation of whooping cranes as efforts continue to establish a self-sustaining flock in Wisconsin. Ann Lacy, you've got a problem in the Nisida Wildlife area, from what I understand, with black flies, and it's a serious problem with cranes.
Yeah, and probably most people listening may have experienced black flies, and so they can maybe identify. They are tiny, tiny biting insects, and the Yellow River, which is parallel to the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge in central Wisconsin, apparently is the center of the bullseye for really, really big black fly population. And what happens is they will target these nesting birds. They're sessile. They're just sitting there. They have that beautiful red head that is skin, and it's red because it's engorged with blood. And it, if the conditions are right, kind of warmish weather, low wind, no rain, they can really attack, and in mass. And it's not surprising that some birds are physically driven off of their nest to find respite.
You know, we had a similar problem with loons in the North Woods, with flies driving them off of their nest a couple of years ago. But the thing that strikes me is the black flies are terrible for the whoopers, but they don't bother their more common relative, the sandhill crane, as much. Why is that?
Well, not that we know of. Not what we know of. That's something that, you know, we have a list as long as my arm of things. Well, we should look into this and we should look into that. And so we're trying to tick down that list of all of these things that we're wondering about, just like that. But you have to remember also that there's a lot of sandhill cranes in the state. And so it's hard to know how many of them are actually driven off of the nest by black flies. So it might happen, but it's also swamped by the number of sandhill cranes out there. So could be driven by experience. It could be driven by some of these genetic issues that we're talking about. All of these things play in.
Now you were trying some biological warfare against these critters by introducing a special natural bacteria in 2011 and 2012 that kills the black fly larvae. How did that go?
It went really well, but the results indicated that in the years where they treated the Yellow River with its BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis, and the I is Israeliensis is the specific bacterium that targets the black fly larva. And in years where they used that, there was substantial increase in nest success. So the birds that sat on a nest either through 30 days or that actually, and maybe the eggs didn't hatch for one reason or another, or eggs hatched. And so that experience kind of told us that maybe this is something that we could look to in the future to help increase that nest success. This year, that was not used, and nature took care of it for us. The conditions this spring were kind of cold, windy, rainy. All of those things helped to keep those black flies kind of at a low ebb all the way through the nesting season.
You know, if Nisida is the epicenter of the black fly in the Midwest, was it a bad choice in retrospect for a place to try to develop a second flock?
Well, I don't think so much a bad choice, because that was just one thing of all of the considerations that they had. the Nisida complex with Meadow Valley Wildlife Area, Monroe County flowages. It's a beautiful area for cranes. Lots of food, lots of nesting area. It's fairly remote, so they have their privacy. It's a really great area for cranes in general. So here's one thing that may or may not affect them in the long term. But it is true that we don't want to concentrate, and this is a horrible bird pun, all of our eggs in one basket. So that did encourage us to look for other areas in the state that may be appropriate for cranes, that kind of think about it as a forced dispersal, I guess. We introduced them to areas like Horicon National Wildlife Refuge and White River Marsh is where we're now conducting some of these releases. Once these birds return, they have high philopatry is the technical term, so they want to return home. And so when they return home and try to set up nesting territories in their future, they can choose areas in there that seem appropriate. So we're kind of spreading out that population and not concentrating everything in Nisida.
So you'll have them in Nisida, Horicon, and White River Marsh. Will they all be wintering in the same spot in Florida?
The birds that are led by our partners in Operation Migration, they are taken to a Florida wintering site. And then after that, they can choose wherever they want to winter. And for some reason, there's birds that return to the Florida area in their first year, and they kind of bop around. And again, in the winter areas, they also choose what's best for them. And some, they bop around in Florida. Some stop short in Tennessee, some in Alabama, and some even winter in Indiana. So as it turns out, they only go as far as they feel that they need to, where they can find a safe open water for roosting at night and food. And so they kind of choose their own after that.
Well, I would love to see a bopping, whooping crane. We've got a full slate of callers, and I know this is an important subject for our listeners, so I want to get to as many of you as we can. Let's go to Kelly in Jefferson, who's been waiting patiently. Kelly?
Hi. I'm visually impaired. And I was wondering, what's the difference between a sandhill crane and a whooping crane?
Oh, excellent. Well, the biggest difference is whooping cranes they're a little bit bigger than sandhills, and they are lily white. So the sandhill cranes tend to be gray. They paint their feathers with mud in the spring, and so it turns kind of a rusty red. So the gray ones and the red ones, they're still both sandhill cranes. But for someone who may be visually impaired, or when you're sitting inside your house and you hear crane calls, the sandhill has that very distinctive rattling unison call that the male and female do, and you might hear them on migration, that way, way, way up high as they fly over. And I can't do a good whooping crane, but the whooping crane call is slightly different, and it's more of it's literally a whoop. They are named after their call, the whooping crane.
And
so you can tell the difference between calls.
And you've got an oddity this year. You've got a hybrid whooping crane and sandhill crane that you've named Whoopsie.
it did adopt that name. It seemed very, very appropriate at the time.
The father is a whooper and the mother is a sandhill. How did that happen?
That is probably a direct result of the fact that we don't have a very big population in Wisconsin. So there was a male whooping crane that was released into the Horicon area, and it had established a territory in the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, and it decided to choose a sandhill crane female as a mate. And that's because there was literally no other female whooping cranes in the area, unfortunately. And so we think that it's a direct result of this low population that we have in the area.
Well,
so,
if they've been able to produce an offspring, those two species have to be closely related, to get back to Kelly's original question.
Sure. Yeah, that they're pretty close, and you know they look similar in size, and you know, and hybrids do happen in nature. It happens in probably an unknown amount, but we don't feel that this is a natural situation. So that's why we had to remove that bird from the wild to try to encourage that bird to go back to a whooping crane mate, and really, you know, our goal is making this a sustainable population. And so that was the reason that we felt that we needed to do that. And hopefully he will, you know, we have two cohorts of birds that we're releasing this year.
Right.
Quite a few of them are female, so we're cautiously optimistic.
Will Whoopsie be sterile, or will she be able to reproduce?
It's interesting that, you know, the definition of a hybrid, you know, they should be sterile, two species mating together. There has been research done of other crane species that have hybridized, and some females may be able to lay fertile eggs. Males tend to be sterile, there actually is a question about that. And again, this hybrid can contribute to science, you know, by learning more about exactly what these hybrids do.
So you're separating the male whooper and the female sandhill. Did I understand that right?
Well, that would be ideal, but of course, cranes have their own ideas about whether they want to be separated or not. That would be ideal, and we have an opportunity if we can capture this bird. We need to replace his radio transmitter. All the birds in the population have radio transmitters, so we can identify them by their unique frequency, in addition to the color bands that they have. And so, what we would do is we would physically move him to another location where we have a safe enclosure set up and where he would be in proximity to other whooping cranes. So it kind of remind him, like, oh, there are other whooping cranes out there. They happen to be a lot of females in that area, too. And our hope would be that he might make a love connection up there.
Let's go to Jay in Reedsburg. Jay, you are on with Ann Lacey of the International Crane Foundation.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to say I saw my first whooping crane in 1962 with my father, and I was 5 years old, and he said this might be the last time you see this bird. And then over the past few years, I've seen them just south of Reedsburg in a reclaimed wetland area before they venture out of that area. So I'm so happy you're doing this work, and it's just amazing.
Oh, thank you, Jay. It's absolutely uplifting to hear stories like that, because that is exactly the goal. Is there were many people that thought, you know, myself included, I've gone to see birds that, you know what, I want to see them before they may not exist again. And that's really our goal, to help this population become something that is as normal and natural to see as all the sandhills that we see here in Wisconsin. Thank you.
And, Ann, we should emphasize, too, that your organization, the International Crane Foundation, is not working just to conserve the whooping cranes and save them. You're working to conserve all 15 species of cranes around the world. That's a big job.
That is. Cranes occur on 5 continents throughout the world, and we have projects or partners that we work with in every single one of those places. And there are some cranes that are doing better than others, we have here in Wisconsin the world's most numerous crane, the sandhill, and the world's rarest crane, the whooping crane.
You work
and
in
so
that
juxtaposition is really interesting.
You work in North America, East Asia, South and Southeast Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. How do you keep from being stretched too thin?
It's difficult, but you know, as a small organization, and who'd have thought that the World Center for the Study of Cranes would be in Baraboo, Wisconsin? But just through luck and ingenuity, that's it's how we do it. And we really leverage our partners in those other countries and work that other people are doing. And we rely on partnerships to do a great, great deal of work. And if people would like to learn more about all of those projects, we have all a wealth of information on our website, www.savingcranes.org. And all of our work is described there.
1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to talk to Ann Lacey, the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. That number again is 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email message to talk@wpr.org or put a comment on the Joy Cardine Facebook page. On your website, Ann, you list a number of ways in which you're working to save cranes. There's a whole list of them: safeguarding the population, securing ecosystems, bringing people together, securing water resources, promoting clean energy. Addressing climate change is also on that list. Why is that important for the survival of cranes around the world?
The one thing that I think most people can identify with cranes is wetlands. And so one of the things that the climate changing, becoming warmer, really affects is water. And without water, most crane species will definitely suffer. So, for example, the whooping cranes on the Texas coast, that is a very, very critical area for whooping cranes and innumerable other shorebirds and water birds that winter there. And with sea level rise, there could be very drastic changes, even with a few inches of sea level rise. So things like that are very, very critical. Rainfall patterns changing, wetlands drying, other areas becoming inundated that might not be appropriate for cranes. So those are things that we really are tracking on, making sure that we have the right amount of appropriate habitat for cranes going into the future.
Well, a few inches rise in the ocean, that could drown the salt marshes that the whoopers depend on the Texas coast. I don't know if there's any way to stop that right now. How can you react to it in order to save the crane population?
Yeah. So, again, color me an eternal optimist. But for as much as we may lose due to sea level rise, it also will create areas of new salt marsh. And so what we're trying to do, for the very specific example, again, in Texas, is we try to do some modeling, try to project into the future and see if water level rises X amount, what new areas may become available in Texas, and working with Texas landowners to either protect their areas or acquire new land to add to the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, for example, or create new protected areas for whooping cranes. So those are some things that you can do. You can try to do that projection into the future to protect new areas.
Carrie gave us a phone call. She wanted to know about a huge highway going through a bird refuge in Texas. She was wondering about the safety of whooping cranes when they winter down there. So human beings, you know, if we're not careful, we can affect a real delicate balance.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the biggest threat to cranes is people, quite honestly. I don't know of the very specific road down in Texas, but I know right here in Wisconsin at Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, the Highway 49 going through the top of that refuge is infamous for the damage that it can do to wildlife, unfortunately. And so those are some of the other things that we try to educate people about, you know, what our impact is to cranes and other wildlife that we might not be able to see. So polluting wetlands, power line issues, you know, making sure that power lines are marked so cranes don't fly into them. And actually one of the biggest threats to cranes is shootings, illegal shootings. People taking pot shots at cranes and killing them. And that is really a big part of what we do to educate people to try to get that to stop.
And Ann, you're also promoting clean energy from your website. I'm going to just read the line here. The rapidly increasing production and distribution of energy worldwide poses serious challenges for cranes. Vast, highly toxic tailings ponds resulting from tar sands excavation in Canada appearing along the migratory route of the whooping cranes and one of the most heavily used flyways for water birds in North America. So you've got the cranes in this isolated part of Canada, but trouble in paradise.
Yeah, the tar sands are fairly, that's a relative term, it's fairly close to the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, and it's near the flyway. So between cranes and, again, the other millions and millions of waterfowl that nest up in the Arctic region fly through this area. So that is a physical something that can really do some damage to large populations of birds. But there's also smaller things like, you know, that we have wind farms.
And hold that thought. We'll pick up on wind farms when we come back from our news break. Our guest is Ann Lacy, the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Joy Cardine. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to talk to Ann Lacy about efforts to save the endangered whooping crane population. But first, this news. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Joy Cardine, and we are into our final segment with Ann Lacey, Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, as we look at Wisconsin's whooping crane flock and some of the threats it faces both here in Wisconsin and more generally from habitat loss, environmental pollution, and climate change. If you ever seen a whooping crane, do you think they will ever again be common in North America? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And Ann, when we stopped for the break, you were talking about the dangers that wind farms pose to migrating birds. Wind farms, of course, green energy, but green energy that might not be quite so amenable to healthy bird populations in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. And of course, you know, they place wind farms in areas that have a lot of wind, and those tend to be flyways for birds as well. And we are working with many partners to determine exactly what the threats are specifically to cranes. But we do know that where you have wind farms, you might have an increase in power lines. And so that's really one of our focuses, is making sure that we get the power that we're going to use, that we need, but making sure that the power lines are protected from cranes, that they aren't at risk to flying into them. But one of the biggest problems is that when you have a very low population, everyone that you might lose to an accident with a power line or shooting or something like that hits even harder. So again, we try to make sure that we can build this population up, encourage them to be sustainable on their own. We don't want to have to place whooping cranes or other cranes into the world in perpetuity. So,
well, you mentioned
that's really
people. You mentioned people shooting whooping cranes either intentionally or unintentionally. We had a caller who's concerned about the proposed sandhill crane hunting in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Conservation Congress has introduced resolutions that would permit sandhill crane hunting, and it has been pushed by at least one assemblyman. Are you concerned that if we allow people to shoot sandhill cranes, they might shoot whooping cranes by mistake?
It is absolutely a risk, and there has been sandhill crane hunting in the Central Flyway for many decades, and there have been whooping cranes that have accidentally been shot. Currently in our flyway, in the eastern flyway, the birds that summer here in Wisconsin fly through Kentucky and Tennessee, where they do have sandhill crane hunting seasons. And that we know of, there have been no accidental shootings there. But it's always a possibility. And so we really encourage people. It seems like the sandhill crane hunting season comes up perennially. And for those people that feel strongly in any direction, to really make your voices be heard. Tell people why you do or do not want sandhill cranes in particular to be a hunted species. And this is a very valid reason why people may not want them to be hunted.
Let's go back to the phones. Jillian in Madison, you are on with Ann Lacey of the International Crane Foundation.
Yes, good morning. I just had a question. Ms. Lacey, you mentioned five continents where there are cranes.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, presumably one where there aren't is Antarctica, but where's the other one?
Cranes, a good guess. There are no cranes in Antarctica. There are no crane species in South America. So the farthest that cranes go in this hemisphere is that we have sandhills that winter down in Mexico, but that's as far as they have gotten, and they still breed up in the northern latitudes. So there aren't any crane species in South America.
Interesting. Why is that?
That's it. It's just one of those things. As species have moved up and down through the continents over the millennia, they probably just haven't, you know, as they moved down through North America, this was good enough. There are close crane relatives in the bird world in South America, but no crane species.
Let's talk about what it takes to raise these whooping cranes in captivity, and there's quite a bit to it. You take the eggs off of the nest, and then you have to incubate them, and then your workers, your researchers, have to go through a lot in order to get them ready to fly south. They have to dress up in costumes. They use hand puppets. Tell us about that.
It's amazing. So, yeah, we have aviculturists, professional people that know how to deal with cranes in captivity. So my colleagues here at the Crane Foundation are specialists in that. So we do raise some eggs that come out of the wild. For example, we talked about the birds that may leave a nest because of black flies. We do try to salvage those eggs and raise those in captivity. But most are created by the birds that we have here in captivity and other captive centers. So we do all sorts of genetic mumbo jumbo is the technical term that I use. It's some math that it is beyond me even. But we really try to make sure that the genetics of these birds are as good as we can get them. And then our aviculturists will raise these birds. They have to be in costume so they don't see people, that they see something that is big and white with a red head, so they know that they are whooping cranes. And just how is this for one tidbit? People might not know how big a crane is, but it's pretty small when it starts out, and they grow very, very quickly. 113 pounds of food per chick per year, just to make sure that it gets big enough to be able to fly on its own so we can release it back out into the wild.
I imagine those crane costumes get kind of hot on those hot summer days.
Thank goodness they're white, but they are head to toe, and we wear black rubber boots in addition to that. So if you can imagine last week when we actually finally had some hot summer weather and humid, it really tests our staff. But they are out there 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. Interns that are learning how to do this kind of work from our professional staff that have been doing it for years.
So. And then getting them to follow the ultralights on the migration to Florida, how many pilots do you have? What kind of training do they need? And what kind of people are they? You know, it's got to take a special kind of person to want to do this kind of work.
It is indeed. Our partners in this reintroduction at Operation Migration are in charge of training these birds from when they're in eggs to recognize the motor of an ultralight, so it becomes natural to them. And they raise the birds also in costume, but they have to not only endure heat in the summertime in costume, but they also have to fly an ultralight plane in costume. And so they usually aim for being able to have their birds up and trained and recognizing that ultralight plane as their leader. By the beginning of October, they aim to start their migration, and they begin that slow process to lead those birds on a migration all the way to Florida.
I want to squeeze in one more phone call. Let's go to Carrie in Stoughton. Carrie, you're on with Ann Lacey of the Crane Foundation.
Oh, hi, Ann. I was wondering if you could comment on the case that got turned down recently by the Supreme Court. It was the Aransas Project versus Shaw, having to do with the water being released into the rivers that flowed into the Aransas Wildlife Refuge, that, you know, having to do with the salinity levels in the water and the crane die-off that happened in 2008-09.
Carrie, we got it. And if I can just summarize the court case, this was to ensure that the crane population in Texas had access to fresh water. The case claimed that the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which is responsible for issuing the water permits, violated the Endangered Species Act when fresh water didn't reach the wintering grounds. There was a die-out. The circuit court held that the Texas water managers were partially responsible. That was overthrown by the appellate court, and now the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to take the case. How big of a setback is that, Ann Lacey?
No, as far as a setback, we always try to look for the positive, and it was one of those things that we or do we not want it to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and it would have been great to acknowledge that we have these water problems, that we need these freshwater systems that are healthy for cranes and other birds, but it is what it is, and we have such great partners down on the Texas coast that continue to build this awareness. And the story is much, much too big to obviously go into here. So I really encourage people, if they wanted to know more, to look trusty Google and look up the Aransas Project for the just enormous amount of information that goes on down there. But it really highlights the need, the simple need for fresh water in a lot of these systems, and to keep these ecosystems healthy for crab populations, which benefits people and birds and business and that whole ecosystem on the Texas coast, which is reflected in coastal areas worldwide. So it's all about the water.
And we're running out of time, so we don't have a chance to get her live on the air. But Heather in Bloomer wants to know how the loss of wetlands in Wisconsin affect crane populations.
Well, the interesting thing is we have such a healthy sandhill crane population here in Wisconsin because Wisconsin has had the foresight, I don't know, years ago when people were draining wetlands for agriculture, again, when that westward expansion was happening, we have managed to save about 50% of our historic wetlands here in Wisconsin. So, actually, things are looking pretty good, and so we just really, really need to ensure that we maintain that 50-ish percent that we do have and try to make sure that they remain protected and to encourage private landowners and businesses to really understand the importance of wetlands to cranes and to all the myriad other things that we don't see, but that wetlands are really, really important for.
And Lacey, one final question. Do you think wild flocks of whooping cranes will be a common sight in Wisconsin again someday?
Yes. Yes, I do. With the help of everybody in Wisconsin and everybody worldwide, and with if we can continue our work, that is really our goal, to make sure that everybody gets to drive to work and say, oh, yeah, there's a whooping crane. That would be great.
We want to thank our guest, Ann Lacey, the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. You can find out more about the Crane Foundation and the work they do on their website, savingcranes.org. That's savingcranes, all one word, .org. Thanks to our show producer and show director, Christy Taylor. On-air production by Elizabeth Deliquis. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Joy Cardine. Up next, it's the Week in Review as we look at the week's top international, national, and state stories with our guests, former Republican congressional candidate, former Iranian hostage, and former financial advisor Kevin Hermaning, and former Democratic State Senate candidate, member of the United Nations, and CEO of Indian Country News, Paul DeMaine.